My name is Dick Peterson, and this is the session on apartheid. It's subtitled, Tutu, the Gospel Trumpet, Marches Around This Wall for the Seventh Time? And, I assume I don't have to explain the title. It's just I always like to come up with some kind of a title that's, that sort of says what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of Joshua 5, the walking around the walls of Jericho, and the seventh time it counts down. And I was thinking of the wall in East Berlin coming down, and I'm just kind of hoping the same thing might be true of apartheid in South Africa. So. Well, when you attend this coming Sunday church services in Lutheran churches, you'll run across two of the scripture lessons that seem to speak to me pretty well to the problem that Bishop Desmond Tutu faces as he carries on his struggle against apartheid in South Africa. The first lesson is from Ezekiel 33, and it's the one where God says to him, "Now, son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Wherever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give them warning from me. If I say to the wicked man, you shall surely die, and then you don't speak a warning to that wicked person to turn from his wicked ways, the wicked person will die in iniquity, but his blood I'll require at your hand." So that's one of the lessons, and it goes on a little bit more. And the other lesson, the second lesson, is from Romans 13, where Paul says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, the one who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment." So, when Bishop Tutu returned from, he had some opportunities for schooling and some work in England. He came back to South Africa in 1975 to take up his post at Johannesburg. And since that time, he's been preaching for justice and equality and respect for people regardless of their color of their skin there in South Africa. And he often finds himself speaking against policies of the government regarding apartheid. And so it kind of raises the question, is he violating the words of Paul in Romans 13 when Paul says, you know, be reflective of the good of the, you know, the governing authorities, they're there by God, and so you treat them with respect in that. Or is he responding to the command from God in Ezekiel to the prophet that, you know, if somebody's doing evil, it's your responsibility to tell them, because if they die as a result of the evil and you haven't told them, then you're responsible. I think much of what he's doing puts him between those two kinds of parameters. What I want to do today is look at some of the ways that Bishop Tutu addresses the concerns that he comes across in South Africa regarding apartheid and its effect on people. The way he takes certain Bible texts in sermons or in letters and things, and he addresses, he'll give a sermon using that text, and then the way that he interprets the text in the light of that particular problem of apartheid. It's like doing theology from the perspective of trying to overcome apartheid. I think it's just kind of interesting. I took two or three of the texts that he uses in his book called Hope and Suffering. It's the one that's over there in the bookstore, but I only could find two books that he wrote, and this one seemed to have had a couple of very well illustrated sermons in this respect. Since I used to hear more from him on the mass media before Nelson Mandela was released from prison, but since he's been released, he's really become the basic spokesman for what's going on down there, and you don't really hear, I guess the newspaper people don't follow Bishop Tutu around like they used to. So, but I think there's enough here that can give us an idea of flavor of how he uses his theology, his Christian faith, to respond to these issues in South Africa. This first one, he was once criticized by supporters of apartheid for being a political person rather than a Christian leader. And so he taped a message that was going to be delivered at the 4th anniversary of the All Africa Church Conference in Nairobi, Kenya. He taped it, and it was presented as a tape at that conference because his passport was withdrawn by the government, so he couldn't make the trip. This is just a little samples of what he said in that. He said, a familiar remark which has been almost a parrot cry is don't mix religion and politics. He says it's a remark which is made not because a politician in his election campaign introduces a moral or religious element. He says, no, we almost always hear it when a particular political, social, or economic fact of life is criticized as being inconsistent with the gospel of Jesus Christ as most Christians understand it. If that fact of life or policy is described by religious leaders as being in accordance with Christianity, then there's no question in this instance of religious people being accused of mixing religion and politics. If you agree with what is, that's fine. And then he gives the example that the White Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa for a long time sought to provide scriptural justification for the National Party's policy of apartheid. And nobody ever said, don't mix politics and religion to them. Says, but when other Christians declared apartheid to be abhorrent to the Christian conscience, then people were told that religion and politics belong in separate categories, that it's wrong to mix them. And he says, even some who do think that religion does have a bearing on politics still may warn that it's not good to mix religion and politics. They say they want to avoid confrontation at all costs. They say, in these kind of situations, God is neutral, and so the church should be neutral. He said, there's a need, as you see these, the people that are repressed as they rebel and try to bring the issue up. He says, we need to forgive them for these kind of disruptions. And at the same time, they don't ever ask for repentance on the part of those who are perpetrating the injustice or for any redress of the unjust conditions. He says they do this to such an extent that the profound Christian words like reconciliation and forgiveness are rejected with contempt by these poor and exploited people because in their eyes they're just being asked to acquiesce to the condition of oppression and exploitation and powerlessness that they're being put in. He says, this group of Christians who want to take this approach, they forget that reconciliation is no easy option, and it doesn't rule out confrontation. He says, after all, it did cost God the death of his Son to effect reconciliation. The cross of Jesus was to expose the sinfulness of sin when he took on the powers of evil and routed them comprehensively. We cannot cry peace and peace when there is no peace. And then in the same speech he was saying, and does it in fact say that God really is not much interested in what happens Monday to Friday? That he's only interested in what happens on Sunday? That he doesn't really much care about the plight of the hungry or the dispossessed or the voiceless? That he does not take sides? Does the scripture say that, he says? And he gives us a little illustration. He says, when two people are engaged in a conflict and one of them is considerably stronger than the other, to be neutral is not just and fair and impartial, because to be neutral is in fact to side with the powerful one. He did never add any more to it, but if he was, the idea that God was really going to be neutral, then by necessity he would have to side with the weaker one to balance it. So if you're going to insist that God's going to be neutral in those kind of situations, then you have to agree that God is going to be on the side of the least powerful one to balance it out. They never say that.
Isn't his position that that's what the United States is doing as a body too?
I think so. We probably
basically they're siding with the powerful ones.
Sure. And he's probably thinking of a number of churches in South Africa that take the same position.
They
don't hold it against anybody, but you don't want to get too involved in it. Okay. Now, so that's interesting. I think the way he just exposes what really is a complaint against him when when he's speaking against apartheid, if he's speaking for things, then he's not considered mixing his religion and his politics. Now, there was a sermon he gave once to people in a place called Duncan Village, East London. It was back in 1981, and he entitled it The Village of Nabook and Duncan Village. And what he does first, he tells the story of Naboth's vineyard. Are you familiar with that? It's just, remember, King Ahab, he has this fine castle, and right next door Naboth has a vineyard, and he wants the vineyard, and he goes down and asks Naboth to either sell it to him or trade it to him for another vineyard of equal value or something, and Naboth says, "Hey, this is my heritage, I won't. And Ahab went back home pouting. Jezebel says, "What's the matter, Ahab?" And he tells him about this, and he says, "Well, aren't you the king of the country?" He says, "Just relax, I'll take care of it." She goes out and gets some people to call a banquet, and then a couple of people accuse Naboth of blaspheming the king and God, and so they take him out and have him stoned to death. And then Jezebel comes back home and says, "All right, now Ahab, you got the land." And along comes Elijah. Elijah finds Ahab down in the vineyard. Ahab says, "Oh, you here again? You know, you enemy of mine, you found me again." And he says, "I sure did." And he says, "You're not going to eat anything off of this property. You're just going to die here. And you're going to have the same pile of blood that is Naboth's, because he was stoned to death. You're going to have a pile of blood like that too." And Ahab repents. He throws on sackcloth and terribly repentant. And so then God says, "Hey, Elijah, you see how Ahab is there? He's so repentant. We won't hold this on him during his lifetime. We'll do something to his children." Of course, Jezebel doesn't fare so well. She falls out of the, eventually falls out of the, out of the, or pushed out of the window, and the dogs eat her up. So it was a wild story. But anyway, he says, "Now, you people in Duncan Village," he says, "this is a story I want to leave with you people." He says, "In this country, you are regarded as of no real importance. You're told by those who are powerful in the land that you must move from your property because they want it. It does not matter to them that you do not want to move. You, like Naboth, are saying that your homes and your sites are not just ordinary property. They are part and parcel of who you are. You were threatened with removal some time ago, and so you were not sure that you could afford to improve or maintain your homes, and so the village is deteriorating. Your community is being destroyed. It's almost as if you are being stoned to death as a community, just like Naboth." And he goes on, "You're nobodies in this country, the land of your own birth, and those with power think they can act against you with impunity and that nothing will happen to them." He says, "Now I want you to remember, I want you to remember, and I want them too to remember, that God cares. God cares about injustice, about oppression, about exploitation. God cares and always takes the side of those who are trodden underfoot. Injustice and evil and oppression will not last forever. They have been overcome by God in the cross of Jesus our Lord. As we protest the evil of your threatened removal, we must do so knowing that victory is already ours. The authorities will ultimately fail because what they're doing is evil and against God's law. You must be strengthened to resist what is evil. There's enough land for everyone in South Africa. It's just that some people are greedy, and at the same time they're also powerful. And so they think they can satisfy their greed at the expense of others whom they think are unimportant or without power. But these are they whom God supports. South Africa, please remember the story of Naboth's vineyard." What he's done, he's really addressing this to both parties involved, because I think he wants the South African government to remember what happened to Ahab when he repented, and that there's still some time for change despite the announcing doom. And the people, he wants to have them lifted up and encouraged with the conviction that even though the government is not in favor, still there's a distinction between the government policy and God's will, and that he wants them to know that when they're with God's will, they're in the stronger party. So I think it was a... Now, that just, there's one more of these. And this is a time when, two Sundays ago in the Lutheran Church, our Old Testament text was Exodus 6, verses 2 through 8, story of Moses is called by God and told that he's supposed to go down and tell Pharaoh that the people are now to be let go, because it goes like this. God said to Moses, and I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, I didn't make myself known to them. I established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they resided as aliens. I have also heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are holding as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will free you from the burdens of the Egyptians and deliver you from slavery. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and a mighty act of judgment. I will take you as my people. I will be your God. You shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has freed you from the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord. And the verse that we didn't include in our pericope, but which is included here, it says, Moses told this to the Israelites, but they would not listen to Moses because of their broken spirit and their cruel slavery. Now, Tutu uses the whole series. That's the reason I wanted to add that last verse. But when he's giving a sermon on this text, he brings out these particular things. He says, first, that God has heard their cry and seen their affliction. And he says, that proves that God is very close to you. He can see you and he can hear you. So you should know that God is close. And then he says that on the day that he appeared to Moses, he talked about deliverance, that proves to you that God cares about you. And then he says that, and then God remembers. He says these old promises he gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, well, he's going to fulfill those promises to you. So he remembers. He's a God who can be trusted. And he says, now of course when you're a slave, what you really want is to be set free. And God does this wonderful act. He sets them free. He's not just a talking God, but he's an acting God. And he takes sides. He's not a neutral God. He took the side of the slaves, the oppressed, and the victims, and he's still doing the same even today. He sides with the poor, the oppressed, and the victims of injustice. So he says he will take our side, and he will rescue us and lead us out of our slavery, out of our poverty, out of our suffering. He will make us his own people. Then he goes on, this is where verse 9 comes in, he says, but the passage says something else. It says that they heard Moses, but they did not believe. They could not hear him because their spirit had been broken because of their cruel slavery. This is a terrible thing. Their slavery had dehumanized them. They had come to believe that they were not quite as human as the Egyptians, that they were somehow inferior, second-class human citizens. They had what we call a slave mentality. Now we all know what that is, don't we? We know just what this sense of inferiority can do to people. We develop a self-hatred and despise one another as a result. And we treat one another as scum. Have you seen how we drive our cars in Soweto? And I've never seen this, so I don't know. But he says, in Soweto we stop our cars anywhere because we despise one another. And we treat each other as little worth. So they just park in the middle of the street and don't worry about who's behind them or anything. He says, nurses and teachers, even ministers and their peers often treat fellow blacks as if they don't count. We do not deserve to be liberated because we're so divided. And Tutu reflects on the Exodus liberation and how the difficulties of the experience in the wilderness, they were full of dangers and hunger, and people longed to be back in the bondage where the flesh pots of Egypt, where they could get some food. And so he says, we too must remember that liberation is costly. It needs unity. We must hold hands and refuse to be divided. The ruler, he says, always wants to divide and then rule. We must know that before we reach our promised land, there will be bannings, detentions without trial, deaths in detention, there will be treachery and disloyalty. Let us be united. Let us be filled with hope. Let us be those who respect one another. Then he quotes Paul in Romans 8. He says, if God is for us, who is against us? And then he quotes the whole thing and concludes with, nothing, in Christ nothing can separate us from the love of God. That's the end of that sermon that he gives. And that was, again, I always think of these when these texts come up, and we're going to have them in our own church services, that just how it's interpreted here for us, and how Bishop Tutu interpreted the same text for the people that he addresses in his sermons in Soweto and those places down there. Well, that's all the real content that I was going to share with you tonight. Just, do you have any reactions to the way that he interprets like the Old Testament? There's anything different than what you're used to have heard before? Can you think of the last sermon you heard about Naboth's vineyard? You remember what kind of applications you heard at the time? Have you ever heard a sermon on it?
I can't remember.
Many years ago, and I don't remember it.
It isn't one that really gets picked up very often. Usually in this country, we seem to go into the New Testament text pretty frequently.
Right, I think we're doing what is Romans.
Old Testament sermon anymore.
Are we doing Romans, a whole series of Romans? It must be the second reading. Or the Gospel. I guess they're doing the Gospel on Romans. Well, they don't do Old Testament very often.
That these Exodus texts are just really powerful if you're looking at it from the side of a people who need to be liberated from somebody else. Thinking like the difference for like the Exodus event, I may have mentioned this once before, I think today, that what Moses has to do is just figure out some way to get Pharaoh to let the people get out of the country. They don't have to really change the system. They just have to do something powerful enough to get the government to let them go. Then they're going to go someplace and they're going to set up their own system in the Promised Land. But for Tutu and for Martin Luther King Jr. and any of those others that have used these Exodus texts to talk about how God liberates people from oppression, they had to stay where they are in their particular culture. They had to change the culture because that was to be the setting for their Promised Land experience. They couldn't just run away. They had to stay in there and fight, or not fight, but get it changed somehow. I can visualize that the American Indians might be interested in Naboth's vineyard stories. They have a strong sense of place. They've been moved on to reservations and things like that, but every once in a while you read a lot more in the newspapers now about the Indians in North America, in Canada and other places, where they're finally feeling they have the legal wherewithal to say, this development shall not take place in this location because this is a sacred place for us. This is where spirit and we people meet each other, or something like that, and so you don't make it into a golf course or this way or whatever. Put up your high rise or something.
Yeah, they run into a clash when they start some of these ancient which graveyards that the Indians remembered, I guess. And you read that in the paper once in a while, somebody started building something there and they're disturbing the graves of the Indians.
There's a lot of history of the misuse of that. People used to go around and find graves and dig them up and take whatever they could take out of there and take it home. And didn't think there was anything wrong with that. If somebody went to their own graveyard and their mother and father's bones and took them out and took them home and put them on their, that'd be different. But it was just an Indian, so it was different. And it's interesting to see they finally have enough lawyers and people in the Indian nations now that they can look back at all these promises that were made to them in the past.
There was a big settlement in Alaska that was pretty, that kind of got things started too, I think, sometimes. And they they paid them for their land.
Yeah.
And about every Indian there got quite a bit. I mean, they've had legal people working out for years and years, and they finally settled. I don't know how long ago it was. But
that one has some. I think that one has some drawbacks to it, if I remember right. It was a couple that were in our church over in Kirkland. They spent the winters up there teaching in one of those remote schools, and they said that the problem with the arrangement at that time, it was about 10 or 12 years ago, that they bought and they gave the land, the money to the people, the Indians, but the part of the clause was that within like 10 years it would become taxable land to the government.
Oh,
so, you know, by then they didn't. Yeah, and so, and they weren't going to have enough money, and so they'd probably end up losing it back to them anyway by taxes, but meanwhile they used all the money to over drink and stuff. And
quite a problem up there with them, the drinking problem. They get me belly dizzy, and I guess they had nothing else going on.
It's like when the Australian brewery brings in beer into Papua New Guinea.
That's
the same
something
thing.
Kind of strange.
We had the same problem in Liberia. You know, talk about whether the church boats should be used to run the beer up to the people or not. We had a big argument there. Phoebe had 317 acres of property turned over to him by the government to make this hospital on, and there's a lot of extra land. Well, they also have this kind of a green revolution kind of thing. They're supposed to be using every piece of land for agriculture that they can. Well, some people moved in on the back end of the property and started growing sugar cane back there, and then of course the next thing was that they brought in these little juice mills. So they're manufacturing some pretty strong cane juice back there. And so this is all taking place on the church's property, you know. And I was a chaplain in the hospital, at least once a week some guy had come in, lost his hand or something in one of those cane juice things. And still, I mean, there was no regulation on it. And finally the parish had just gotten to place, the parish was responsible to oversee who was using the land, as long as they didn't do anything more that the hospital didn't want them to do, but they just decided that they were going to have all these cane juice operations off of the property, and they had to let them whatever amount of time it would take to finish growing that particular crop that was in the ground and that stuff. They were going to give them that much time, but they were going to phase it out. They felt like it was the wrong thing for the church to be involved in raising cane juice on the property. But It's a struggle.
Well, Tutu hasn't been at all discredited, but his fellow preacher there, is it Basma, or the one who was just recently discredited in some way for moral laxitude and so on, I was just wondering if that spilled over to Tutu's sphere of influence, and if that's why we're not hearing so much about him, or if it is just Mandela.
I don't know. I looked in the paper. I just don't ever see anything about him.
But he certainly knows his people.
The paper tonight now, Mandela's wife is being taken to trial for that killing back in '88 that she was accused of. You never know whether that's a kind of pretext thing to discredit of movement.
I thought she pretty much admitted that she didn't have very good control over those bodyguards. Anytime you get something going like that, any little thing that could discredit the actions of the leader, it just really throws it into turmoil, I would think, particularly if they're working in the name of God and
trying to appeal to the international community, where more is a much more significant
and
thing.
It makes it so difficult.
You always wonder on these, you see that mayhem down there goes on, you're so polarized. I wonder, and I guess Tutu is working on that too, and Mandela keeps reminding me. As long as they can't get together, they have no trouble. They're not going to make an advancement the other way. I guess that's
the different tribes fighting each other. And it was interesting that the de Klerk, fairly recent newspaper seemed to indicate that he was willing to agree that it was that fighting between the blacks was being stirred up by whites that were kind of moving themselves into that, trying to make it happen. He was investigating it, whether the investigation will ever come out with anything, but
seems like there's always a group that wants, there's few in the country that don't want anything settled, the same way we got over in the... Over in the, right, or in the Arabic, there's someone there, they're going to say, somebody starts selling something in peace, they want to come out and start killing somebody to get it started again. And I don't know, I often wonder if they really feel like they're making any progress by doing this. I guess they feel kind of helpless. I think that's the least they can do, get them right.
I think what's frustrating is, you know, the Afrikaners, they have good Christian churches, and I suppose... You're very selective, I think, about your interpretation.
The whole history of when the Afrikaners moved in the borders is something like people moving the west over here.
Yeah. Did you read Missioner's Covenant? Did you read that? That's really, I mean, I don't know how accurately true it is. It's big enough. But it's just really about the whole development of the whole settlement of South Africa. And he spends a lot of time where they justify positions against certain races by quoting the Bible and stuff, and it's just it's a really good, I enjoyed it. I thought it was just, he's usually sort of, you know, he builds a little bit of fiction into it, but he's usually done a bunch of research, so it is, the general flow of these things is pretty good. I know it was for like Centennial when he wrote about Colorado, we were living out there.
For Iberia though.
I don't know what that is.
It's all about Spain and the development in Spain, and plodded along one little town after another forever.
It's hard to stay with you.
Really a lot of words, a lot of words.
Yeah, it seems like he has to put together about 2 inches worth of paper for every book he writes.
Past the first 100 pages, you can. It then starts to develop. It seems like he's lays an awful lot of groundwork for his all of his novels.
I hadn't even heard of that one, though. Covenant, huh?
Covenant, yeah. I was reading it over in Liberia. The humidity over there, the book kept getting bigger and bigger. I could never get through it. It was about this thick when I got through reading it.
Because of the humidity?
Yeah, you know, it just swells the book up. I'm sure New Papua New Guinea the same way with the whole thing. I think it's some people use the prophets primarily as jumping off places for predicting the events in the Gospel of Matthew, and then really don't think that there's too much other value to the Old Testament prophets. And the third world and these the liberation theologies that are, you know, that are developing, like in South America and all over Africa and places, and I think it's well for Christian communities everywhere to be aware of the power that's involved in the Old Testament writings to a people who are oppressed and looking for a pathway to freedom. They can discover a God who reaches into history and political systems and balances them out so that the people who are being oppressed can be freed up. And there's a lot of power to that. You know, they may have to come to the same place where we do, where you continue to read it and find out that once they're set free, there's a lot of danger there that you just turn around and make the other people what you were before, which is what we did in the United States. People came over from Europe because they were oppressed and couldn't have freedom, and then they established systems that gave them freedom and very defined freedoms. But then they treated everybody, you know, just started treating the Indians and other people just like the Israelites did the Canaanites.
In the black, or in the countries in Africa where the blacks have been to win power, they are basically doing it, aren't they? I mean, they're abusing the people, the black people in the country, even though they're black leaders.
Yeah, they still have a strong tribal system of, you know, you get the boss man. The boss man has to be in charge of everything. But like I said, that did happen in Liberia, you know, when it was 1820s when the slaves from here that were freed went over to Liberia. They basically set up a government along the coast and refused to let the people inland have anything to do with the government and just sort of treated them as slaves like they'd been treated when they were in the United States. So that's always the second part of the problem when you pull off a liberation movement in some countries, it's just what happens after that. So we hope that they'll continue to read the scriptures. we in turn will read them in a supportive way for them during their movement out of oppression.
There was a book written in Congo Kitab, was written by a fellow over there. They was in a Belgium, one of the countries that the Belgians were in control of when they moved out. And I thought that was very interesting. Mm. They moved out, of course. The people were in fairly good shape at the Congo at the time, I mean, reasonably, but they were under foreign control. And then when they moved out, foreign control, and then people took over, and they wound up, I guess, with a dictatorship. But the fellow was a pretty strong character that was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling about some of the adventures he'd had there. He wound up getting tangled up with a crocodile, and he drove about 40 miles or more. And he was the only one there. The black fellow was with him, panicked and took off because he figured the alligator would kill him. And he drove with, he was a real bad wound, but he drove in the first place he came to, he knocked on the door. Some was missionary or black something, but when he opened the door, they shut the door and slammed his face because there he's all bloody and they don't know what's going on. So he had to drive on and finally got to an aid station and he lived through it. He was a pretty strong character. Yeah. That was an interesting, yeah, Katawa. But I thought that was kind of a personal story that showed what was going on. And he was riding an elephant through there, and there was this other dictatorship, and they had to move out. But he would just kind of, by force of effort, because they're used to him kind of controlling things, the big guy, they were out there shooting people like that or getting rid of them, but he'd just give them a lecture, and he'd tell them off, and he was riding this elephant by this place where...
he had a certain stature, he had the elephant.
The elephant came by, well, when he was leaving the country, and he had kind of a pet, an elephant that he worked with there. And he came to this place where this dictator, I can't remember exactly the story, but he said the elephant obliged him by dropping, putting the droppings right in his front yard as they drove by. He said, the elephant, I guess, would show his disrespect for this.
Yeah.
But the soldiers, I guess, moved in and told him to get out. Or they were leaving, so.
There's still a lot of other countries, even like Kenya in Africa. I mean, we went over there for 2 weeks vacation, and you can have a very comfortable vacation there. And still, but while we were there, the Minister of Foreign Affairs was shot and stuff, and acid was dumped all over his body and stuff. I mean, there's some student riots and things there, so that's not all well either. In Tanzania, I think the economy is way down in Tanzania. I haven't had a chance to talk to any of the missionaries from there lately, but it's really.
Well, Liberia is considered a democracy, isn't it? But it really isn't there.
Yeah, it hasn't been for. Never has been. I don't think. It was all on paper. I mean, it's got the constitution follows the pattern of the United States, but. It's always had certain strong people that define how it's to be interpreted. And they say these other countries, Zimbabwe and places, the white people that are still there, they're stuck there because they can't take assets out of the country that amount to anything. And so there's going to be a lot of turmoil there for a while. Hopefully, I'm really hopeful for the United Nations that they can get out of the Gulf without a war down there. If they can get the United States and Russia, you know, agreeing on topics, so they're just not automatically boycotting each other's vote on everything, and they could get a good solution to, you know, a peacekeeping force or something, I think they could really do a lot of good around the world now. I think Cambodia is going
stronger now.
Yeah,
if Russia get on her feet, I think they would really develop more. There'd be more of that.
Sure. And right now,
they've got their problems all kinds of problems.
They're willing to be cooperative with the United States right now because it's good for Gorbachev's image in the world, and hopefully the United States will use that well and not use that to put them in a situation where they get too embarrassed.
No, they'll just go over and develop their oil field so we can drive faster and further.
Right. I mean, we just skip the Near East and just go
right,
and use their oil.
Right, go right over and use Russia's oil. Well, the exciting thing, and I think the hostess mentioned it, is when you get a people that becomes liberated in a Christian faith, they're so exuberant about their faith, and they put us all to shame. I remember writing a PMV, and there was a fellow with a Bible in one of the seats, and he had half the bus was gathered around him, and he was telling everybody about Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And he was reading from the Bible, and the bus was almost, you know, tipped one side because so many of the occupants were gathered around him, squatting on the floor and listening to everything he said. They were so eager for the word. And of course, in Ethiopia, the Christian religion is just extremely mm-hmm. strong. And is that part of the Old Testament too? The liberation?
Yeah.
It puts us sort of to shame.
The young people were seeing at the marketplaces, just, you know, they were just so really exuberant and joyful, and you could just feel it. And they say that one of the problems they're coming to me now is the Pentecostals, they are starting to win them away from some of our churches.
Yeah, there's no place else, no place in the world where Lutherans can sit around historically and expect the church to stay with them.
So the Lutherans there see that they're going to have to get, you know, mm-hmm. be joyful to keep their people.
Uh-huh. Yeah. If we can just put together the, you know, the strong heritage of convictions and teachings that are part of the Lutheran faith and still get some life into the music and stuff, you know, I think he's got great possibilities for being a real great asset to the world liberation and the gospel. So keep working on it at this end too. I'm sure in the States it's going to be the same way. Okay, well, I think we can maybe call for this evening, give you a little break before we have the chapel. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.